series of reports called the Facebook Papers. Her memoir is titled The Power of One, How I Found the Strength to Tell the Truth and Why I Blew the Whistle on Facebook. Frances, yesterday, yes, Meta CEO, billionaire Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg was grilled about Instagram's effect on the mental health of young users. What struck you most about what he had to say? What was true? And do you believe he told the truth?
I don't know if you've noticed over the last couple of years that he's shown up on a number of podcasts where he often gets tossed pretty softballs. What was remarkable about reading the coverage of Mark's testimony yesterday was how different it is when the person sitting across from him asking the questions gets to ask hard follow-up questions. You know, things like, you know, he's bragged before on other podcasts about not fearing ever being fired because he could, because of his stock ownership in the company, he owns the majority of voting shares or the majority of the votes. He could just put in a new board if they tried to fire him. You know, having to actually have a meaningful conversation about what is the implication of that level of extreme control. You know, he's never had to sit there and squirm while being asked questions like that.
And Frances, just tell us, you were you're a former Facebook whistleblower and advocate for social media transparency. What did you learn being within Facebook? What did the companies know about the addictive potential of their algorithms and content?
So within the child safety space, you could say there's kind of two major areas. One is the well-being of kids, and I would say that's where work on addiction falls. And then I would say child safety, like dealing with predators, dealing with people who distribute child abuse material. I worked within threat intelligence, which was the nitty gritty hands on investigators going in there and hunting individual people who were running scams, running terrorist organizations. My team worked on counter espionage. So the closest I saw firsthand to how Facebook underinvested in the safety of children was that the team that was responsible for, you know, finding people who were distributing child abuse material or looking for adults that preyed on children or finding, you know, there are these marketplaces where adults solicit nude photos of children from the children directly. That team was so strapped for resources that if you'd given them a single engineer more, they probably would have accomplished 10 times as much. Right. That's the attitude that I saw repeated at Facebook firsthand. The documents I brought out, though, painted an even broader picture. So while I saw things that made me uncomfortable when it came to kids, what the documents of Facebook showed was that Facebook viewed them very instrumentally. You know, they cared about the role of teenagers in bringing in their younger siblings, bringing their parents onto the platform. They worried about public perception, not the actual health of the kids, but the perception that the products might be addictive. And what we know now that these documents have been brought for because of the court cases is that there were lots and lots of experiments being run to make these products safer. They knew that the kids said these changes, things like don't send me an alert in the middle of the night, made kids less stressed, let them sleep better. And yet they didn't launch them because it also made them use, you know, Instagram 1% less.
So what did these companies know and when did they know it? I mean, you have Zuckerberg testifying. This is under oath. Last week, after Instagram CEO Adam Mosseri spoke on the witness stand, he pushed back on the science behind social media addiction by denying users could be clinically addicted. Can you talk about that and the case that's at the heart of the trial, the 20-year-old woman known as KGM, who says her addiction to using YouTube and Instagram worsened her depression and suicidal thoughts?
So this is one of these little turns of phrase that I think is it's a wonderful illustration of how Meta, Facebook, Instagram have gotten very, very good at speaking in a very precise style where factually you can defend what they say. So addiction is a medical term. So if I get addicted to painkillers, if I get addicted to cigarettes, like going off of cigarettes, because your nervous system has become dependent on nicotine, you go through very intense physiological symptoms, where you go off painkillers, you're going to literally be vomiting, right? When kids stop using social media, if you isolate that child, you do see things that are indicative of their brain chemistry is changing. You know, they're used to tons and tons of dopamine. Now they don't have that stimulation. Like, I think any parent who gives their kids a lot of screen time and then tries to have them sit still for dinner or like makes them go on family vacation and leave their phone behind sees that behavior change. But from a medical standpoint, that behavioral dependence is not considered medically to be addiction. But when you come in there and downplay what happens with compulsive use, which is the scientific term of art around these things, it really downplays how having a generation of children who get hooked at 7, 8, 9. Because remember, 30% of 7 to 9-year-olds were on social media as recently as 2022. Imagine what it is today. When you have kids whose brains are being just bathed in dopamine from, you know, scrolling all day at such a young age, it changes how their ability to sit still in class, to interact meaningfully face-to-face with their family or friends. And you see this from the growing number of reports from teachers who say, I've taught for 20 years and I don't understand what's going on. The kids who come into my seventh grade class have never behaved like this before. So that's kind of the consequences that we're living with of having, as the court documents show, they've been getting warned about this for 10 plus years. And yet they continue to optimize for spending more and more time on these platforms.
As we said, we're also still joined by Laurie Schott, who lost her daughter, Anna, and is attending the trial. Lennon Torres as well. And Laura Marquez Garrett. Ramin?
So, Laurie, let's go back to you. You said about your daughter, because it's not just concerns about what these children, young people are putting online, but also what they're receiving in response. You said about your daughter, I was so worried about what my child was putting out online. I didn't realize what she was receiving. So could you tell us what precisely she was receiving and how you came to see it?
Well, with Anna Lee, she, after she passed away, we were able to gain access into her platforms. And from what I saw at first, opening that as a parent who lost a child and trying to understand this world of social media, it brought me to my knees. This child was pushed content about anxiety and depression. And it wasn't just one or two screenshot images. It was pushed to her constantly. And it was just time and time again the same theme that pulled her down that rabbit hole. It hooked her into this world that just destroyed her mental health, that told her she wasn't good enough, that told her she was broken. My daughter was not broken. These platforms are broken. Mark Zuckerberg is broken. And we're here to fight for change on that, because no child should be exposed to what my daughter, you know, saw. And we tried tirelessly as parents to guide her, and she was a beautiful person, and they took that person away from us.
Laura Marquez Garrett, you were just with both Laurie and with Lennon. You were attending the trial. You're here in New York. As you were getting ready for the show, I saw your tattoo on your forearm. Can you pull back your jacket and show us the significance of this tattoo?
Sure. So I have two, and these are my children's names, and each of the rays of sun is a child that's been lost to social media and or AI product. Right. And it's, and these are patterns.
How many?
296. That's not all of them. That's just the ones that, that we've either drafted and filed their complaints, or we've met their parents and come to love these kids.
And what does it mean when you file 1,200 complaints? Complaints to who? What happens?
There's unlimited. So we file them in state and federal courts. Look, we're filing them. This is one of many cases. We have the federal, the MDL, where you have the attorney generals, you have school districts. We have one-off state court cases in Delaware, in New York, in we had Vermont, Connecticut. Essentially, with these companies, I mean, these are the best resourced companies in the world. And so it is a fight. It is a battle. And we are trying to find those points where they need to be held accountable, where we can break through and where we can hold them accountable.
So, Laura, you, as you mentioned, of course, you're an attorney for the Social Media Victims Law Center. If you could give us an example of what it would mean to place restrictions on social media use that would protect children. We just heard earlier in our introduction about a child child who died while participating in a blackout or choking challenge. So just explain, what kinds of restrictions are we hoping for?
Sure. So these are design defects, right? So think of the Pinto. It's not a restriction as much as fixing it. And fixing a defective part, a part that is exploding. It's not, you know, someone asked me the other day, well, Meta's saying they're fixing it, they're doing this. And my answer was, that's kind of like sticking a fire extinguisher in a Ford Pinto and saying, there you go. We fixed it. It's still a defective part. And so ultimately fixing it, and they know this, it's in their documents that are becoming public, they could remove the addictive mechanisms. They could, it's as simple as think of your television set at home. We have this remote control. We got to turn the volume down, up, change the channels. They've kept those controls on the back end, right? They could give you the option to slow down the algorithm.
Explain the algorithm. For people who aren't familiar with social media, what does it mean when Lori Schott said that her daughter, Ann Lee, kept being fed with the same thing, going down a rabbit hole?
Sure. So these are social media algorithms specifically, because there are many types of algorithms, and these companies have programmed them for engagement first. So, you know, we have instances where children, and we have the data, children will look for uplifting speeches, inspirational quotes, and they will get breakup and suicide, right? You have, and we have this over and over. We literally have images we can provide where a child looked for this and got the opposite, not because they wanted it, but because TikTok determined this is what will keep this kid hooked. Now, if a child is going through a breakup, and this is Mason Eden specifically, he looks for, I believe, was inspirational quotes. If TikTok had shown him what he sought out, what would he have done? Well, potentially he would have put it down and he would have talked to someone. They don't want that, right? So they're programming for engagement above all else. That is a programming choice. It is frankly a form of profiling, right? They're taking thousands of data points that our children, we as consumers, we're not consenting to that. We're not saying yes. I mean, they can tell you the kind of car you drive, your education, all of these pieces that they can then use to profile and target. And in the case of vulnerable children, it's deadly.
So you mean that, literally in this case, a child is looking for inspiration.
Yes.
And instead gets, in fact, quite the opposite. I mean, the way that we're, as adults, familiar with the way that algorithms work is that, for example, on a news site, you look at the same news site, you keep getting fed the same news site. This is extraordinary that the child is receiving something that is exactly the opposite. And you're saying that's because it's more addictive?
No, that's the defect. So you're thinking of like search engine algorithms, right? If I go into a typical search engine, it's programmed differently. It's designed differently. If I search for Chinese food restaurant, I will get, here are some Chinese food restaurants within a 5-mile radius. If I go onto Instagram, I may end up with a beheading video in China, right? Something that, and actually, and I'll use an LGBTQ instance, because I had a young person say to me once, you know, when I would look up gay pride on Instagram, I would get half gay pride and half Westboro Baptist Church, you're going to hell. That is what these algorithms are doing. They're not showing our children what our children are asking to see. They're programmed to show them what they think they cannot look away from, which are car accidents, extremes, outrage, all of these things. And that is what is causing harm.
Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen, as we wrap up, you see at the Trump inauguration, the billionaire brotherhood that includes Mark Zuckerberg. Mm-hmm. How does that influence the lack of regulation that we're seeing today?
Before I do that, I want to put one tiny little thing into add a cherry on top of what Laura said. There's a lot of really basic things that you can do even to make the current system safer. For example, they know, they've asked users before and said, does this content make you feel bad? And if they saw people beginning to look at more and more and more content that people say, when I see this, it makes me feel bad. If they just gave people a choice and said, hey, we notice you're looking at more and more depressing content. Do you want to keep doing this? You can do very simple things like this. But when we look at the oligarchs that run these tech companies, we've set a norm that we are supposed to just trust them, that they've given us these wonderful, quote, free gifts, even though the price of these gifts is ourselves, our kids, our data. We've been told, you've been given such great gifts. We know so much, just trust us. And that age of just trust us needs to end. We need real accountability, real transparency, so that people who build better things get rewarded bringing us social media that actually is good for us.
Lennon, we just have 30 seconds. You're with the HEAT initiative, which focuses on applying strategic pressure to big tech companies. But I want to ask you as a young person, your advice to young people on social media now.
My advice is to demand better and to force Mark Zuckerberg and the other lazy, lack of innovative CEOs to step to the side and let true innovators show you what digital community and connection can actually look like.
Lennon Torres, Senior Manager of Programs and Campaigns at the HEED Initiative, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen. Lori Schott, her 18-year-old daughter Anna Lee, died by suicide in 2020. And Laura Marquez Garrett, attorney at the Social Media Victims Law Center based in Seattle. Laura was just named to the Time 100 list of most influential people in health and are featured in the documentary Can't Look Away. Laura will be honored tonight by Time. Coming up, we look at the breaking news. The brother of the king, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, has been arrested because of the Epstein files. And we'll look at the number 4,400. That's the number of times judges around the country have ruled the Trump administration is detaining immigrants unlawfully. Stay with us.
The misanthropic, misbegotten merchants of gloom, who look into their crystal balls and prophesy our doom, let the death knell chime, it's the end of time. Let the cynics put their blinkers on and toast our decline. Don't become demoralized by this chorus of complaint. It's a sure sign that the old world is terminally quaint and tomorrow's gonna be a better day. No matter what the siren voices say, tomorrow's gonna be a better day. We're gonna make it that way.
Singing Tomorrow is going to be a Better Day in our Democracy Now! Studio. Coming up, we're going to look at the breaking news. Andrew, formerly known as Prince Andrew, has been arrested on his 66th birthday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh, but first this.
A major investigation by Reuters has found hundreds of judges around the U.S. have ruled more than 4,400 times since October that President Trump's administration is detaining immigrants unlawfully. Reuters reports, quote, the decisions amount to a sweeping legal rebuke of Trump's immigration crackdown. But the administration has continued jailing people indefinitely, even after courts ruled the policy was illegal. This comes as the number of people in ICE detention has reached about 68,000 this month. That's a 75% increase from when Trump took office last year.
We're joined now by Brad Heath, enterprise reporter for Reuters. He co-wrote the article, Courts Have Ruled 4,400 Times ICE Jailed People Illegally. It hasn't stopped. Brad, lay out this expose.
Sure. We've been looking at cases in which people detained by the government during the immigration crackdown have come to court and said, I am being held illegally. You know, you are required to give me at least an opportunity to be out on bond while the government is trying to deport me. And that's something that for almost 30 years, the government has done pretty consistently. But starting last summer, the Trump administration made a big push to try to keep everybody locked up while these cases were going on. And we found, you know, 4,421 cases involving more than 400 judges who said these detentions are illegal. You know, the government can't just deny people bond and hold them indefinitely in this way.
And so, Brad, what's been the response to this expose?
Well, I mean, things have kind of kept on as they're keeping on, and the number of lawsuits coming into the federal courts is just piling up and up. And it's a pretty striking number. You know, there were 20,000 when last I looked, and I think the pace is actually accelerating. Now, there's been some action. There was a federal judge in California yesterday who tried to block the administration's policy of just denying people bond globally. And we'll see what effect that has. But, you know, so far, these court orders saying this policy is illegal have not caused the administration to change it.
Tell us about 18-year-old high school student Joseph Thomas from Venezuela. What happened to him? What did the judge rule?
Yeah, he was a Venezuelan. He and his father were both asylum seekers. They'd been in the country since 2023. They were arrested after a traffic stop. They both had work authorizations. They were doing like a delivery run for Walmart, I think. And the government denied both of them the opportunity to be released. So they filed lawsuits along with tens of thousands of others at this point. And two separate judges ruled that the government had to release them. So both have since gone home. But to get there, they had to go through this process of like obtaining a lawyer and going to the federal court, which is not how it used to work.
And Brad, could you talk about the impact of this flood of lawsuits on the functioning of the overall judicial system?
Yeah, it's really been quite striking. And we saw like a little bit of it crack into the public view a couple of weeks ago when a DOJ attorney just complained to a judge, you know, about how bad the system was and how she wished she could be held in contempt so she could get 24 hours of rest. But the, you know, the pileup of these cases is like nothing the Justice Department was equipped to handle. We've found 700 DOJ lawyers who've been assigned to these cases, including people who've been pulled off of criminal prosecutions. There are some lawyers whose name has ended up on more than 1,000 civil lawsuits just since October. That's a really hard caseload to keep up with. And one of the upshots of the government being so swamped with this is when courts are actually ordering, you know, that this detainee be released, the government's having a hard time making that happen.
So if you can talk also about the droves of lawyers who have left the Justice Department, and also talk about the lawyer who recently said in court, lost her job, but she just said, this job sucks.
Right. She doesn't have the job anymore. You know, this would be a challenge, I think, for DOJ at any time, even with a fully staffed Justice Department. We saw some records last year that about 2,900 attorneys left the Justice Department through mid-November 2025. Some people taking the kind of fork in the road, early retirement. A lot of people just resigning. Pretty impressive, you know, hundreds just being fired, I think. So the civil division in Minneapolis, for example, that would normally take on these cases where hundreds and hundreds have been filed is down 50%. And the U.S. attorney went to court and said, we cannot keep up. You know, we are every day responding not just to habeas lawsuits, but to orders from the judge saying, show cause why you haven't released this person yet. And the chief judge in Minneapolis has faulted the government there for not complying with dozens and dozens of orders that people be freed.
Brad Heath, want to thank you for being with us. We're going to link to your articles for Reuters. Courts have ruled 4,400 times that ICE jailed people illegally. It hasn't stopped. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with breaking news. In the United Kingdom, police have arrested former Prince Andrew, the brother of King Charles, on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Authorities say they're investigating a complaint over allegations that the former prince had shared confidential material with the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince was the UK's trade envoy between 2001 and 2011.
Back in November, King Charles stripped his brother of his title as Prince and Duke of York and evicted him from his royal residence over his relationship with Epstein. We're joined now by Michael Walker, contributing editor at Navarra Media, where he hosts the organization's flagship live news program, Navarra Live. Today is, I was going to say Prince Andrew's, but it's Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and he has been arrested on his 66th birthday. Talk about the significance of this.
Yeah, I have to say, on our show, we're still calling him Prince Andrew because I don't think the royal family can get out of this so easily. Just saying, we're taking the title off him. It's got nothing to do with us, Gov. They obviously knew he had a relationship for a long time before they stripped his title of that. In terms of this particular case, it's actually remarkably similar to the row. Well, it's more than a row, isn't it? The investigation into Peter Mandelson, which is that what these emails appear to have revealed is that when there were powerful men in positions of responsibility and influence, they used that influence, they used that access that they had to forward on confidential information that was sort of that should have been kept secret to Jeffrey Epstein. In the case of Mandelson, that involved what was going on in number 10 Downing Street. When it comes to Prince Andrew, this seems to be what was discussed on trade trips. So emails indicate Andrew forwarded official confidential trip reports from Singapore, Vietnam and China to Epstein shortly after receiving them. So that seems to be what the police are currently investigating. And their job is to judge whether this reaches the threshold of misconduct in public office.
Yeah, and it's clear that a misconduct is a really complicated offense, a misconduct in public office. This is, I'm reading from the BBC, quoting the legal correspondent. It essentially boils down to an allegation that someone who was doing a job on behalf of the British public did something seriously wrong, knowing it to be wrong. But there are four elements or factors that the police must investigate. If you could elaborate on that and also tell us, where has he gone and what comes next? Where was he taken?
Well, so he was taken to a police station for questioning. Now, people think that's significant because he wouldn't have known he was going to be arraigned. So often when it comes to crimes which were committed, well, I should say alleged crimes, investigations into alleged crimes committed in the past, you might get forewarning. You might get invited to speak to the police. Now, it seems they didn't want to give him forewarning. I suppose there is an understanding that Andrew is someone who likes to prepare for interviews, and I suppose they wanted him potentially to be a bit more candid, to not have his lines prepared. When it comes to the actual crime, which, I mean, he's being investigated for, political journalists are sort of desperately trying to catch up on this because it's not something which has appeared in sort of political debate very often. It's the sort of crime which, as far as I understand, tends to be levelled at people like prison officers. So it might be someone who's working in a prison office or working in a prison, I should say, in a position of responsibility, and they help a prisoner speak to a gang member outside and potentially arrange for some sort of crime to be committed. So it's, I think normally you have a very high threshold and it's a bit more open and shut. What's interesting here is that, you know, I'm not sure what they'll be investigating because we've all seen the emails. The question is just whether or not this meets this threshold. I suppose they'll be discussing with Andrew whether or not he knew that what he did was a breach of his responsibility in that role.
You know, what's astounding, Michael, is you have Andrew being arrested. And here in the United States, we have not seen as much fallout. In fact, I think President Trump just said that the millions of pages of documents have exonerated him, though he was named over 1,000 times. Next up could be, is that right, the former British ambassador to the U.S., Mandelson, who also, interestingly, was a trade envoy. And there are questions about revealing information that was given over to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting here and what's disappointing to some people, actually, is obviously this is a story about sex trafficking, about the abuse of numerous women. And it seems like where justice might be brought, it's on a different charge, which is sharing confidential information with a powerful person. In both cases, Mandelson and Prince Andrew, there are suggestions that maybe they were quid pro quos here. So when it came to Mandelson, he was sharing this information, which was market sensitive and which would have been useful to Epstein. And it seems that in return, what he was getting was Epstein's help in helping his lobbying firm after he left government or getting a job with JP Morgan. These seemed to be what he was considering. He didn't end up getting a job with JP Morgan, but he was clearly from the emails angling for one. With Andrew, we know that
we're going to have to leave it there. But we thank you so much for being with us with Novara Media in London. And today marks Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary. On the air, our first show, February 19th, 1996. We've got a show Nermeen as well here in this image. On Monday, we'll be celebrating Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Maria Ressa, Michael Stipe, Wynton Marsalis, Mazhab Abu-Toha, V, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and more. We'll be streaming the event live at democracynow.org. Happy anniversary,
Happy
everyone.
Anniversary,
Happy
Amy.
Anniversary, Nermeen.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life.
At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.